in Los Angeles. Today's forecast from the National Weather Service, sunny and warm, high of 86 inland, cooler near Lake Michigan. This morning, 65 Kenosha, 64 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, happy to be sitting opposite Doug Instanis, the managing and artistic director of the Racine Theater Guild. And we are talking today at what sort of feels like the outset of another season at the Racine Theater Guild. It's actually a season that began this summer with a very fun little musical called First Date, but as September rolls around, things are underway with a really marvelous production of an old Agatha Christie classic called Murder on the Orient Express. Doug Instanis happens to be the director of that production, as he was of First Date. And we're going to be talking about Murder on the Orient Express, but also all of the other plays and musicals that are going to be part of this upcoming season. And I forgot to look, Doug, at what number of season we are at right now. Do you happen to remember off the top of your head?
Well, it could be 83, depending on if we count COVID years and all that stuff.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, but, there's some debate about that.
Well, it, at any rate, it was founded back in 1938. By 26 people with a budget of $13, and here you are all these years later and doing great, great things. So we're going to start, first of all, with this play that is currently underway that opened this past weekend, Murder on the Orient Express, based, of course, on the famous mystery by Agatha Christie. First of all, what are your recollections of what prompted you and the play reading committee to think of this as a great choice for the Guild?
Well, you know, everybody likes mysteries. We've been doing very well with mysteries, and Agatha Christie is a master at writing those. And this was done at the Rep a few years ago, and some people saw it and thought it was marvelous. And we read it and looked it up and went, wow, this is a great show. But it's massive. I don't know. Can we do this, you know, with all of the tech elements and the train and all the room? And it's quite a technical production. And we thought about it and said, well, you know, it's really a great show. Great parts for a lot of different types of people, young, old, male, female, American, foreign, you know, all sorts of different unique characters are popped together on this train. And so when we thought about it and I did the math downstairs and said, okay, well, you know, if we did this, where could we store it? And we figured, well, let's give it a shot. We haven't done something like this in a while. And we knew it was going to be a stretch. So we put it in the opening show because we had all summer to build it and didn't have any conflicts with performances in August. Because most of the time, you know, we're cranking them out at the Theater Guild. We're down one week and do a tech rehearsal the next week, and we perform the next week. And this show had to be in the first slot because of the size of the technical elements that went, you know, putting it together.
Right. I suspect that a lot of the people listening to this conversation have some acquaintance with Murder on the Orient Express, but for the sake of anybody listening who doesn't, and that might be, in particular, maybe younger listeners, because I think it's if you're of a certain age, you likely know Agatha Christie and know her greatest works. But it's certainly possible someone is listening and not really knowing what this is all about. So just sketch, if you would, the basic parameters of the plot.
Well, Perrault is a very famous detective, a Belgian detective, and he's in a lot of the stories that that she wrote. And so this play takes place in Istanbul, where he is on his way back from solving a murder, and he needs to go back, and he takes the Orient Express back. His friend, Monsieur Bouk, runs the company and gets him a first class accommodations on the train. And the train is occupied by a bunch of unique people. And we have a Hungarian, we have a Russian princess, we have a Swedish nanny, we have English and Scottish person, an American, debutante. We have, good guys, bad guys. We've got all sorts of crazy human beings that are thrown together. And through the course of this, we have a murder. There is a man that we find out murdered a little girl. The play actually starts as a flashback where we see the kidnapping. We don't see. We hear about this kidnapping of little Daisy Armstrong. And we find out that this man on the train, we believe, was the person that kidnapped her and killed her, but he got away. He got away from the authorities. So somebody has got revenge on this man. And so we try to figure out who it is, and I don't want to tell you who it is, but Perrault interviews people, and he, what does it say, he badgers and pesters and becomes a pain in the backside of all of these people. And they're unique, fun, and interesting, and so people need to figure it out. And then at the end, we find out who the bad guys are. So it's a fun story. It takes place on a massive train. It starts off in a restaurant, and then they're on a train, and there's a dining car, and there's a sleeping car, and there's observation decks, and control rooms. And I have more people backstage than on stage hauling out these massive trains and turning them around. And so it's quite a technical feat for us, but it's kind of fun to watch.
It absolutely is. I was just mesmerized by that facet of everything, and I don't, generally speaking, pay maybe as much attention as I should to those matters, but I was just bedazzled by just kind of the technical wizardry of everything. So who's responsible for designing this amazing set and kind of figuring out how to accomplish all of this?
Well, Jane Sarnick is our technical director, and she also designed this one. So we sat and talked about what we needed and what has to happen here, there, and the other place, and she, with a bunch of volunteers, put it together. And, it's a lot of work, and they worked very hard making that all come together.
It really looked great. There were certain points where these big set pieces, like the train, is suddenly being moved off stage. And I thought, where in the world is that going? I of course, know the Theater Guild really well, but I wouldn't have thought there's room for that. And you could tell that very careful calculations have been made about how big can this be and where can we put it when it gets slid off stage.
Every time I complain there's not enough room, she said, well, the door to the shop is 12 feet, blah, 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 inches. It can't be any wider than that. It's like, oh, that's right. It has to go off stage. And then we have to flip it around. Okay, well, the distance from the front of the stage to the back of the stage to make a turn is, blah, blah, blah. And the opening is this long. And so all that had to go into calculations as far as how big this train could be. And when you have eight people on it, it doesn't look very big. But when it's sitting there by itself, you go, wow, that's a massive piece of scenery.
Absolutely. And it looked good, too. I really was impressed by that that aspect of it. Something else that really caught me by surprise, and my wife as well, was we weren't expecting this to be as funny as it is. And I have to confess, I've never read an Agatha Christie novel in my life, so it's not like I come to this with any experience, but I guess I just assumed it was going to be a little drier than it was, and there was so much humor. Tell us a little bit about the adaption of this novel for the stage and and that element of humor that really is a pretty big part of it.
I don't think Agatha Christie is known for humor. However, Ken Ludwig is, and Ken Ludwig is did the adaptation. So he has done a number of them, from, you know, like Robin Hood and some other classics, and he's made, you know, he's put his comic flair. He's much known for a comedy writer, a farce writer, and so he wrote this adaptation, and I think he did put a lot of fun stuff in it. And because I think it's very important, because it's very talky, and reading a book, you can get that stuff, but on stage, you know, you need some action, you need something happen, you need to lighten it up a little bit. And so these unique characters are very fun and silly, and some of that, you know, we have a good time with this murder mystery, I guess.
Absolutely. So Murder on the Orient Express opened this past weekend and runs how much longer then?
It runs through September 29th, two more weekends.
Very good. Murder on the Orient Express. By the way, I meant to ask you, there are at least a couple of different characters, I should say performers in the cast, who do more than one role.
Right.
Is that something specified in the script, and is that typically how it's done, or was that a choice that you made?
It's written in the script that way.
Oh.
And I think it's because two of the characters are only in a couple scenes. And so I don't know, in a Broadway scale or a regional scale, that, you know, it makes sense to hire them to play two roles, because finding people just to do some small roles is difficult. I don't know. I played with the idea of not doing it that way. But, you know, it's a great fun for an actor to play multiple roles, especially when they're very different. You know, one is a Scottish colonel, and he then plays Ratchet, who is the, you know, the stereotypical bad guy, mobster guy. And then we have Michelle, who is one of the conductors on the train, a French guy, and he plays a Turkish waiter. So quite different characters, and I think both the gentlemen that are doing it are having a great time playing both roles.
Absolutely. So Murder on the Orient Express runs two more weekends at the Racine Theater Guild, and I have to say, now I understand why, when you would make mention of it, you had the sort of exhausted look on your face, because this does seem like the kind of show that is, as a former colleague of mine used to characterize, heavy lifting.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like all hands on deck. It is a challenge on so many different levels. It has to feel really great for it to have come together as well as it has.
It does, and there's nothing better, like you said, to watch a well-choreographed scene change where you've got eight people running in, pulling one train out, putting another one in, throwing down beds, and all doing it relatively quickly and coordinated. It's like a nice dance number. So,
yeah,
I'm very proud of them. They've done an excellent job.
For those of you just joining us, my guest on the morning show today is Doug Instanis, Managing and Artistic Director of the Racine Theater Guild. And we have been talking over the last few minutes about Murder on the Orient Express, which just opened this past Friday and runs for two more weekends at the Racine Theater Guild, a really wonderful stage adaptation of the classic mystery novel by the great Agatha Christie. Speaking of classics, as we explore a few other works that are part of this current season, there's another classic that comes right after, and that's kind of interesting planning.
Little Women, yeah. You know, we've been looking at adaptations of Little Women for a long time, and I'll have to be honest with you, you know, it's not something that resonates with me, but it does with everybody else, and every woman I know has Little Women on their favorite character and the story, and I'm drawn by the history of it, and you know, Civil War era, and the fact of women's roles and how to overcome that, and the guest writer, you know, pretending to be a man so she can get work, and it's fascinating. It's a fascinating story, and it's a classic. And I think generations have grown up to love that story. Those movies are all very popular, and they're beautiful, and we root for the characters, and even though, you know, it's similar to Agatha Christie, I mean, you know kind of how it's going to end. This adaptation, takes a more different look at the book than some of the other ones do. So, you know, they all start and end in different moments in these people's lives. But it has all the favorite characters and storylines and, and they've just started rehearsal. So it's very exciting.
And again, for the sake of somebody who is not acquainted with Little Women, you've already kind of given a hint of when the story is set, but maybe just share a little bit more about kind of the heart and soul of this amazing story.
Well, it's about a family, a mom and daughters, actually, who lived during the Civil War, and the dad is away fighting the Civil War, and they have some struggles to try to figure out how to survive in this time period.
Yeah.
And Joe, one of the daughters, is a writer, and women weren't allowed to do certain things during this time period. They're supposed to find husbands and, you know, take care of homes, and that's not how Joe wants to live her life. And of course, then we have guys that come in and they woo these women, and you know, there is a little bit about who's going to get the husband and the rich aunt and trying to do debutante things and, you know, hang out at the rich person's home and play the piano and do things like that. But it's really about sisterhood. Mm. And I think that's what many women are drawn to when it comes to this, is about that type of bond, that bond between sisters, and that I'm going to pull your hair out one time, but then I die for you the next time.
Yeah.
And so they deal with a lot of struggles. They deal with surviving in, you know, Civil War time, with the man being away, and dealing with life and friendships and love. So it covers a lot of different topics. Again, I don't want to give you the ending away, but it's really a fascinating look at roles and how we see women and what is expected of women in that society. And it's kind of autobiographical, you know, not everything is done, but the concepts are all true, right? They're all based on different people and different experiences, and it's put together in a very creative way. There's so many different locations. It's going to be very stylized. The set is going to be a number of platforms and lighting, very theatrical, with historic costumes and props. So I hope people come see it. I think people, if you're a fan of the book, I think you'll really like this adaptation.
Right. It's such a great story, and of course it's been made into several different major motion pictures,
right,
including
and a musical.
Yeah, right, and a musical, and an opera, actually. There's
really
at least one operatic version of Little Women as well.
You're
right. So there's clearly a lot to be enjoyed in this story, and I'm sure a lot of people are going to want to seek out Little Women. It opens on the 25th of October. And somebody else, I assume, is stepping in to direct that.
Lisa Kornetsky, who used to be the head of the theater program at Parkside and has now since retired, and we scooped her up as soon as I found out she retired.
Ah, she's fantastic, so that excites me a lot. So right after that, in the month of December, comes a musical that I think a lot of people will be excited for, and although this is not quite it's a classic, but not quite an old classic like Little Women, best Christmas pageant ever.
The musical.
Tell us about it.
Different. Yeah. Well, before I got to the Theater Guild some 35 years ago or something, they did the play version of the best Christmas pageant ever. That's the first outreach performance we did at the Theater Guild, where we bust in school children. And I believe Norm McPhee added some music to it to make it a little bit longer and flesh it out. And now they've rewritten it and they put music into it. So it's a wonderful, charming story about a community who is putting on a Christmas pageant, and the regular director has fallen and hurt herself, so she can't do it. So a mom has to take over, and somebody tells the naughty kids in town, the Herdmans, about the Christmas pageant, and that they get snacks and food there. So now the naughty kids want to be a part of that. And there's a struggle, of course, between the traditional good kids and the traditional bad kids. And in the course of putting on this play, we learn a lot about the community and the people, and they do it through the telling of the Christmas story, which the Herdmans had never heard before. And it's very touching and very sweet, but it's really about acceptance of other people, and we make judgments about people without knowing their backstory and why they're a certain way. And I think we learn a lot about acceptance and family and community through some really fun songs and some silly lines. And who doesn't want to watch some little kid try to be the angel of the Lord and, and somebody playing a donkey? It's a lot of fun.
For sure.
So it's a lot of fun putting on the best Christmas pageant ever.
That'll be two weekends in December, December 13th through the 22nd. And, of course, there will be some outreach daytime performances for that as well. As we head into early 2025, doesn't it feel weird to say that?
Oh, my goodness.
title, I recognize the words, but I don't remember what this show is about, Over the River and Through the Woods.
I directed this over 20-some years ago, and I love the story.
At the Guild?
Yeah. It's a story about a young man who goes to visit his grandparents, who both sets of grandparents get together, and he goes and has dinner with them once a week. And they're kooky old grandparents, and they love their grandson. And unfortunately, the grandson now has got a job offer out of town, so he might be moving. So the grandparents, of course, have to set him up with a girl to keep him here. So
I do remember this. I remember seeing this. Okay.
And so it's a relatively small cast, but everything stereotype of old people versus young people are in this, with the food, and every time he walks into the place, oh, it's so hot in here, why do you have the heat on? Yeah. And they talk about their illnesses and food, and you're too skinny, and we got to get you married, and they're all trying to set him up with girls, and it's a clash of generations, of course, with the grandson and the grandparents. But it's lovely, it's charming, it's funny. And it's really heartwarming, It's you get to know these grandparents and this grandson, and there's such a love for them. But as with other families, they drive you nuts. Mm. And so it's very funny and sweet. So
yeah.
Over the River and Through the Woods, to grandmother's house we go.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, and that's my not that anyone needs to care what I prefer, but that's my favorite kind of play is a comedy with lots of heart.
Yeah, mine too.
And that's wonderful. Who's directing that? Is that a guest?
Beth Johnstone Bush.
Oh.
You know Beth.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh.
How exciting. After that, this is certainly an exciting part of the season, a play called And In This Corner, Cassius Clay. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it's the story of Muhammad Ali when he was a boy. And it's about him growing up and starting to box, and his story through the Olympics, I think, on his way to the Olympics before he became the heavyweight champ. It's about his life.
So the 1960 Olympics, I think, what he competed in.
So he starts out as a boy and in a gym and dealing with some racism issues and some family things and some struggles and how, the making of a champion, basically.
Hmm.
So we're very excited about bringing that to the stage. We're going to try to do that for our outreach program where we bring kids in. And many productions have used special effects. It has a boxing ring in it. So there's some stylized things that go on with that. This should be a great play for young people to see. Very inspiring.
Yeah. Are you directing that?
No, Sean is. I'm only doing four this year.
That's plenty, I'm sure. So, and in this corner, Cassius Clay, that's going to open in the middle of February. Then after that, Always a Bridesmaid. Tell us about this.
That's a silly, but we tried to do that and COVID shut us down.
So this was on the docket for a few years ago.
Yeah, it's a silly show. Sometimes you just have to laugh, and everything that can go wrong with a wedding does, and it says what it is. It's a bridesmaid. They're a group of friends said that they were going to be bridesmaids forever, but one keeps getting married, and they're getting old, and it's just like, we said we would do this, but not forever,
Right.
And
over and over and over again.
Yeah, and okay. There's like a third wedding. I don't remember exactly, third or fourth wedding. It's silly. It's fun. Everybody can relate to weddings that have gone bad. So if you just want to laugh, this is not a Pulitzer Prize winning book like Little Women or, Agatha Christie type stuff. It's just a hoot, a bunch of really bizarre ladies and friendship and craziness and drunkenness at weddings.
There you go. Always a Bridesmaid. That opens March 28th and runs through the middle of April. And then to finish out this season, the musical Legally Blonde.
Yeah, it's something we've been looking at for a while, and it finally got released to community theaters. It's just like the movie where this young debutante is in love with this boy, and the boy dumps her and goes to law school. And so she, she has a reputation of being just an airhead, not very bright. So she goes to follow him to law school, and she gets into law school, and she ends up there to prove him wrong. And it really is a kind of a switch of stereotypes. She is kooky and fun and pretty in pink type of thing, and caring about her hair and her nails, but she's a good lawyer. She's smart. And so there's a lot of great songs, a lot of fun, and kind of putting the boy in its place for making unfair judgments about her. And she finds a group of friends, and they all learn from this kooky and not stereotypical lawyer.
Right. Carthage did this several years ago.
Yeah.
And I found myself, I guess I'd say, pleasantly surprised. I mean, by the substance of the show.
Yeah.
I mean, it's high energy and, fast-paced.
Yeah.
But I guess I didn't realize that at the heart of it was a story that really said a lot. I mean, this has some really important themes. I mean, amidst all of the fun and craziness and energy, it's a musical that really says something substantial. So Legally Blonde, Rob Cruz is going to be the music director for this. And are you the stage director for Legally Blonde, which will open on the 16th of May and run through early June? So you total all of that with the musical this past summer, First Date, and you end up with quite an intriguing season. So tell our listeners about the not simple process by which a season like this gets put together, gets chosen.
We have a play reading committee that's my advisory committee that's got about seven people on it. Jocelyn Fish is our marketing director, and I are always on it. And then we rotate volunteers in and out of that committee. And it's a really, really hard committee. It's our research and development committee. And they read lots of plays. We're up into 200 different plays that people have reviewed, and they grade. And then we get down to what we call a must-read list, where everybody has come together and put their favorites on there. And then I finally go through them. I don't start off in the process because I don't have time to read 200 plays, but they help narrow it down for me. And then we talk about it, and everybody, the committee is made up of, different people that have different experiences. We have tech people, we have younger people, older people, male, female, you know, people that love musicals, people that love dramas, and everybody makes their case. And, you know, it's a little bit like Legally Blonde. There's a little law school going on. Everybody's making their pitch. And we come together and hash it out and try to come up with a varied season of musicals, plays, comedies, dramas, things that our audience will like, things that are we say we have two people we serve. We serve our audience because we need them to pay the bills, and we owe it to the community to present things that they would like to see. And then we're a volunteer organization, so we have actors and crew that we also want to make sure that they're happy, that there's fun roles and there's some substance to things that they would like to do. So we have two different people that we have to satisfy, and we try to come up with a variety of different things. And I think we've been successful so far.
Yeah, well, this is certainly a fine-looking season that you've just outlined for us. And, of course, on top of that, all of these plays and musicals are not all that are going on the stage of the Racine Theater Guild. Remind our listeners about everything else that happens on that stage through the course of a given season.
We have a children's theater, the Racine Packy Plays. Racine Children's Theater comes to town, and they will be in a couple weekends. We're doing a little Treasure Island thing. We do a four-play season for youngsters. They're about an hour long, you know, $7 a ticket, $20 for a season pass. It's pretty cheap for people, and that we sneak those things in with Treasure Island and My Son Pinocchio, and then Junie B. Jones' Essential Survival Guide to School, and Little Red Riding Hood, a panto. So it's a little four-play season, runs for one weekend only. We've got that going on. We've got a Spotlight Music Series, which my understanding is that the Berg Family Singers might be participating in over the Christmas time, but we do some concerts. We do, we're starting what's called a limited edition series. It used to be our Comedy Tonight series, which allows us to do one night only, or you know, maybe two shows of special things that come to town. We're bringing in an improv group from Chicago. We are doing vagina monologues, which we did last year, which was very successful. We're bringing in a drag parody of, you know, we did the Golden Girls last year, and now we're doing The Nanny this year. And then Michael Perry, who is a very known guy out of the Madison, northern Wisconsin area.
Yeah, wonderful author. I've interviewed him several times.
Yeah, author terrific. And comedian. And so, again, a wide variety of different things happening at the Theater Guild. You know, we, being a nonprofit, and we have our own space, so we need to constantly have something going on at the Theater Guild to pay the lighting bills. So it's kind of like a hotel. You know, if you don't have people staying in your hotel, you can't make that up. You can't double book. So every night we don't have a performance, we lose money. So we have over 160 performances a year at the Racine Theater Guild. So that's quite a lot.
Yeah. And, of course, at the heart of it, not just the actors we see in the spotlight, but all the people who volunteer for crews and so on. I mean, that's the lifeblood of the place in a lot of ways.
It is. You know, as I say, nobody stops somebody in the supermarket and say, hey, did you run props on that show? It's difficult, and they're vital, and they're very talented. You know, the props on this show, Molly Fisher did the props on this show, and they're beautiful, you know, and the costumes are amazing, and it's a lot of work, and for little recognition. And so these people are very committed to us and committed to the community, and very grateful to have their talents.
So if you want any information about all that you've heard in terms of this current season or volunteer opportunities at the Racine Theater Guild, what's the best number for them to call?
Call the box office at 262-633-4218. You can order online and look at our webpage at racinetheater.org, or stop by the box office noon to 6 Monday through Friday, or when we have performances coming on, and just come on in and pick up a brochure.
Wonderful. Doug Instanis, I know it's a busy time for you. Thank you for making time for the morning show today. It's been great to talk with you, and best wishes to you and everybody else at the Racine Theater Guild.
Thank you.
It's 8:44, time for part two of today's morning show here on WGTD. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're starting today's program in really exciting fashion, and I am so excited to be able to meet for the first time a young woman by the name of Bellen Woodard. She calls herself a crayon activist, and she had something happen several years ago when she was just 8 years old that got her thinking about the color of her skin and about the color of other kids' skins and how all of those colors are beautiful. But sometimes we make assumptions about which skin color is normal. And ultimately, this interaction that Bellen had with one of her schoolmates led to her writing a book called More Than Peach, and to creating, a movement around this notion that we need to celebrate all colors of skin. So she is president, founder of Bellen's More Than Peach Project. And we're going to be talking about this beautiful book and the story behind it in the next few minutes of the morning show. The book, by the way, is published by Scholastic Incorporated. Again, it's titled More Than Peach, Changing the World One Crayon at a Time. Bellen Woodard, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning.
I'm really happy to be talking with you. I love the book. And more importantly than that, I love the story. First of all, where are you from? Where do you and your family live?
I'm in Virginia.
Okay.
Northern Virginia.
Great. So before we find out about this interaction with one of your schoolmates that kind of led to all this, I'd like, first of all, for you to just, in general, describe the family in which you have grown up. Tell me a little something about your parents and siblings and what life in your family is like.
Well, all my siblings have skipped a grade, and my dad's actually an educator for middle school. Or he used to work at a high school, then he worked at middle school, and now he actually works in an administrator office. And my mom helps me, and she does lots more too. And so I have four older brothers, and they're all really smart. They're kind of mean, but they're more importantly, we have a lot of fun. And I also hang out with my parents a lot, and I have two dogs, and so I play with them a lot. And so I love having my family and my friends and being able to hang out with them a lot.
Excellent. Right. And at the back of the book, we see not only a picture of you, but we see a photo of you with your four older, tall brothers, and you look like a fun and loving family. So
I actually only have two of my brothers in that picture, then the rest are my grandpas.
I see. I gotcha. Great. So at any rate, it's important for us now to learn the story about what happened one day at school that led to you creating this this book and this whole idea of More Than Peach. So, it sounds like it started out as a fairly normal school day, and tell us what happened.
So, when I was in third grade, so obviously I've been hearing people calling the peach crayon the skin color crayon for the whole time I was in elementary school, and one day when I was in third grade, it just kind of got to me, and I just noticed, I was like thinking to myself, this is confusing because I know there's not just one skin color, and that's not just the peach or brown. And so when I came home that day, I had a conversation with my mom, and I was telling her how kids were calling the peach crayon the skin color crayon, and I told her I knew there was more than one skin color than just the peach and brown. And so she suggested next time for me to hand it over the brown crayon instead of the peach, and I decided I didn't want to do that. So instead, I told her next time I'm going to ask what color they want, because it could be a number of any different beautiful colors. And so when I went back to school, I started using that language, and my teacher caught on, and then eventually my whole class, and then my whole school. And I thought if I could make this change in my community, I can make it across the world. Hmm. And so that's when I started my More Than Peach project. And
So when that schoolmate asked for you to pass the skin-colored crayon, and in a sense, you knew what he was asking for, you knew what color his skin was, and you knew what he was asking for, and so you hand over that peach crayon, even though you know that crayon's not the color of your skin, it's the color of his skin, and so mm-hmm. he's kind of making an assumption. Do you feel like what he was saying, would you call that an innocent mistake he was making, or do you think there was maybe something more serious going on there?
Yeah, I think it was just a mistake because, I mean, I did that too, to be honest. I would just hand over the peach crayon too because I think everyone just kind of learned it that way. And everyone just, that was just the way we did stuff as like 8-year-olds, I guess. And so we didn't really know there was anything wrong about it. And so it wasn't really until I really just noticed it that I realized there was something wrong. But yeah, I think it was just us not really not knowing.
Right. I think one of the interesting things about this is that one of the things that you could have done was to get angry. I mean, to maybe even yell at that schoolmate and say, that is really dumb. Why are you calling it that? And so on. And maybe even a little part of you was mad or maybe hurt, but you decided not to respond with anger. Tell us about that mm-hmm. decision that you made to respond in the way that you did.
Yeah, so I wasn't really sad or upset or angry or any of, like, I wasn't upset. I decided to just take it as a moment to teach someone something, and I was feeling confused more than anything.
Hmm.
And I've always been like someone to really like solve something when I felt something was wrong. And so I just took that, and that's exactly why I had my conversation and thought of a solution.
Hmm. And I should say that there's a page in the book that describes this encounter in your book, More Than Peach, where the character that represents you is saying, this question didn't seem to bother my teachers or my friends. Why was I the only mm-hmm. one feeling confused? So that is what you were feeling in that moment. So tell us a little more about how you broached the topic or what you said the next time to try to get your classmates to think about colors in a little different way.
Can you repeat that, please? Sorry.
So tell us the kind of things that you said to your classmates to get them to think a little bit more about colors and crayons and so on. I mean, what did you say to them and how did you say it?
Well, I would ask them what color do they want, because I know it could be any different color. And so that's actually why later I created my own crayons and my own multicultural, or just my own skin color line with rainbow colors too. But all my skin color crayons and color pencils, art supplies, sorry, are all named after a natural landmark, but they also have a some name of skin color, so that when people pick them up, or kids pick them up, or anyone actually, they can know that whatever they're picking up is skin color, the other ones are skin color, and they're all skin colors. And so, and it's important to know that I created my own crayons with it, so that it can tell a story. The brand can tell its own story, and to really just spread the language.
Right. So there are these crayons that you have helped develop that can, in which people can shade in with whatever color they think is exactly right for that particular person. But it reminds all of us that skin color comes in all kinds of different and beautiful shades, and they're all beautiful. Tell us what the process was like to turn your story into a beautiful children's book. And how did you do that? And what kind of help did you get to figure out how to tell this story in this format?
Well, I started writing during quarantine. So during 2020, when we were shut down, when schools were shut down, and so I started writing that. And then me and my mom had all these calls, and we just started, like, the process. It's been a really long process because, obviously, like I said, it's been like about 2 years. And then we started finding our illustrators, and then which is Fanny Liam, and she did a great job with the illustrations, and we actually got to work really closely. Like, we got to have a lot of calls and work together, and I actually found out that not everyone gets to do that, so I'm really lucky that I got to work with her really closely. And Scholastic also helped me, and they actually published this, they were the whole publisher of this book, and I actually just went to Scholastic 2 days ago now. But so yeah, and we worked really closely with Scholastic, and we've been on so many calls, and it's been a great time partnering with them, and I know we're going to continue to partner.
That's fantastic, and it's really a beautiful book, and I do love the illustrations by Fanny Liam. They really help the story very vividly. I think it's really neat that at the end of the book, More Than Peach, you talk about the way in which all of this has been kind of put together in terms of developing this line of multicultural crayons, and then you give some advice on how maybe other students, other young people like yourself, can start their own drives about issues or concerns that they have. And you even have a list of 8 or 9 different suggestions on things for them to be thinking about. Why don't you share a couple of the main ones that you think are really important for kids to think about if they want to try to mount a drive and make a difference like you have?
Well, I think the most important ones is to talk about it with someone that you trust and have conversations with your parents, your teachers, really anyone. And because conversations can definitely help. And if you're passionate about making a change, then you should be able to just continue to believe in the power that you hold and of you and kidhood. And yeah, and so yeah, and I also just say trust yourself, and that don't let anything to stop you, and just keep at it.
Right. I think advice number one is interesting, which is start small. And I suppose some people, when they see a problem, they're tempted to maybe start big. And you think there's something to be said with starting small. And I suppose that's the story of More Than Peach, is that all of this, in a way, started in a very small and simple yet meaningful way.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So starting small just means that, like, well, obviously when you first start, you're not just going to have a billion people following you, and you're not going to have all these supporters right away. And so you have to continue to make sure you grow, and to start with just brainstorming and how you can continue to grow this project, organization, and have a purpose of why you're doing it. And the purpose is definitely really important, because the purpose can help a lot, lots of people, and not only yourself, but as I said, just a lot of people.
Well, if people want to know more about you and about your project, I know you have a website, morethanpeach.com, in which people can also learn about your multicultural crayons. And, of course, they can also learn a little bit more about this beautiful book, which, again, has been published by Scholastic, and it's titled More Than Peach, Changing the World One Crayon at a Time. And its author, Bellin Woodard. Bellin Woodard, it was great to meet you. I love your book, and I love your story. What a difference you're making in the world. Keep at it, and thank you for being part of the morning show today. I was really happy to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow on the morning show, among other things, we'll talk about the play Puffs, which has just opened at the Rohde Center for the Arts in downtown Kenosha. Today is going to be a sunny, warm day with a high of 86 degrees, a little cooler near the lake. Tomorrow we're warming up to 89. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.